All they do. Jen shook her head. Last time I saw you, you told me you'd come after me, he whispered. That you'd try to stop me. Please, Joan, don't. Just stay away from me. Joan wanted to hold on to him. She released his neck, letting her hand drop to her side. You're a hero, and I'm a monster, she whispered. There's only one way that story ever ends. Nick took a deep breath. When he spoke, his voice shook. I know. And then he slipped through the door and was gone. Joan stumbled through the palace, trying to stay out of the way of the guards. Her body felt too alive everywhere she'd been pressed against Nick. Without the light from Aaron's phone, it took her ages to navigate through the chapel in the dark and to find the hidden door behind the cabinet. She had to keep shaking off flashes of memory. How Nick had dropped his knife before she'd dropped her hand. How raw his voice had been. By the time she found the door catch, she was shaking. Ruth was waiting for her. She grabbed Joan's hand and pulled her through, and just in time, another guest entered just as Joan scooted inside. Hey-ho, the other guest said cheerily. She was a middle-aged woman dressed in robes and a gold headdress. Dumping your host gift too? The woman took a small vase from her robes and placed it onto a shelf. I arrived a bit late. Joan couldn't find an answer. She was relieved when Ruth spoke. Yes, Ruth said a little artificially. She leaned against the cabinet, covering the click of its closure with a cough. Yes, we arrived late too. She patted one of the vases on the shelf. Goodness, the woman said. Where did you get that old thing? The vase next to Ruth was ancient, cracked and repaired. The woman's vase was in the same style, but glossy and new. Joan looked around slowly. The room was full of artifacts, people's gifts for the king, vases and necklaces, bolts of cloth, bracelets, urns, statues, hundreds and hundreds of artifacts, museum pieces from all of history. You know this is wrong, Nick had said. Look around you. Where did you get that vase? Joan heard herself ask the woman. What, this? The woman shrugged. A little market in Babylon. Babylon, Joan said. The hairs rose at the back of her neck. Babylon had been at its height nearly 4,000 years ago. A return trip to Babylon would cost nearly 8,000 years of human life. Joan stared at the woman. She looked so ordinary. Like someone's mum. Had she stolen that much human life to go to a party? Joan thought about the stone statues breathing fire in the next room, the butterfly chandelier, all the marvels here. It occurred to her that they were probably future technology. Human technology stolen by monsters. Was that what Nick had seen when he'd walked in? All these stolen things. Joan, Ruth said urgently. Joan blinked at her. The woman was on her way out of the door, sparing a moment to give Joan a puzzled look over her shoulder. For the first time, Joan wondered what would happen if she and Ruth were on the opposite sides of this. She quashed the thought as soon as it had risen, surprised at herself. She could trust Ruth with anything, and Ruth could trust her. Always. Joan, are you with me? Ruth's dark hair was frizzing out of her fancy bun. Ruth's hair was always like that. It never wanted to stay in one place. Are you with me right now? Yeah, Joan said. Yes. Okay, Ruth said, because we can't get back through the gate. There are guards swarming all over it, dozens of them. We're stuck here. Chapter 18. Inside the halls, none of the guests seemed to know about the break-in. The music was still playing, people were still dancing and laughing. Ruth took Joan's arm, and together they strolled through the hall, past the guards at the doors. The guards knew. They were alert and watchful, eyeing every person who walked past them. Joan and Ruth stepped outside. The party had extended now to the courtyard. People stood talking softly by the light of the moon and the floating lamps. Servers moved between them with food and drinks on silver trays. Ruth led Joan away from the crowd, into the shadows by the hall's stone wall. Her grip was tight on Joan's arm. On the other side of the courtyard, there were half a dozen guards by the gate. Not enough, apparently, to alarm the other guests, but enough to prevent escape. Joan's attention was drawn to a man standing in their midst.
"Conrad," Ruth whispered.
Joan hadn't heard that much fear in her voice since the night their family had died.
"The King's Reach."
Conrad was too far away to see clearly, but Joan could see that he was blonde, in his early 20s at most. There was an air of power surrounding him, and something about him made Joan think of the relentless cold of winter, of still, moonless nights.
"That gate is the only way out of here," Ruth whispered. "What are we going to do?"
Figures peeled away from the other guests. Aaron and Tom. Frankie trotted underfoot.
"Conrad is methodical," Aaron whispered. "He'll check everyone who passes through the gate, and when he finds us," he swallowed, "he'll make a spectacle of us."
"There must be another way out," Joan said. "There's no other way." Tom sounded bleak. "And there's no way to travel out. We're on the mire."
"There is a way," Joan murmured. "We just travelled to the Paleolithic period and back."
She looked at her cousin.
"You need to create another bridge and get us out of here."
Ruth shook her head. Her fingers felt very cold on Joan's arm.
"I can't feel the hunt power right now. It's like I burned it out."
"You need to try," Joan whispered. "Please."
"If we try, we need to be very careful about where," Aaron whispered. "We're almost on top of Downing Street and the Ministry of Defence, Scotland Yard. If we come out in the wrong place."
"I know where we can go," Tom said. "Follow me."
The guests in the courtyard began to murmur as more guards appeared from the halls. Joan could hear pieces of their conversations.
"Something stolen," she heard. "Guards found unconscious."
Tom ushered Joan and the others along the edges of the buildings, keeping to the shadows. No one seemed to notice as they slipped out of sight.
"We won't have long," Tom whispered. "The guards will check everyone on the ground. They'll realise fast that we don't belong here."
They walked quickly. The palace grounds seemed to be structured as a series of open yards, each surrounded by buildings. Soon they were in the working part of the palace. Joan peered through the windows of the heavy stone buildings as they passed. One was a kitchen with huge unlit hearths and benches where food could be laid out. Another had deep basins for washing. It was all as eerily empty of people as the suites had been, and it was dark. The only light was from the moon overhead.
"There's a gate farther up," Tom whispered, "not too far from where Trafalgar Square will be."
He took them through a courtyard full of chopped wood, then past an elaborate brick building with open archways.
"Stables," he said.
"Wait," Joan whispered. She ducked into one of the archways. There were dozens of stalls, pristinely clean. There were no horses in any of them. There'd been no animals on the grounds, Joan realised, except for those brought in by the Hathaways. The woodyard, at least, should have been full of rats and cats and foxes, insects. But here, alone in the stables, she couldn't hear anything but her own footsteps, her own breaths. At the back of the room, there were saddles and neatly folded blankets. Joan took a coiled rope. Then she rummaged through a box of tools until she found a hammer and a couple of nails. When she re-emerged, Aaron put a finger to his lips, and then Joan could hear something. Footsteps in the far distance.
"Voices.
Guards," Aaron murmured into her ear. After that, they walked in silence. Tom took them to a wooden gate at the very edge of the palace where two stone walls met.
The gate was small and unadorned, more like a passage out of a back garden than a palace. Tom drew the iron bolt quietly and pulled the gate inward. They all retreated instinctively from the gaping mouth. On the other side, there were silhouettes of buildings and a wide street. The moonlight seemed to barely touch any of it. Nothing was moving. Joan felt a sick swoop in her stomach, as though she were standing on a high wall. There'd been something awful about the view of the frozen Thames, but now she realized that the horror of it had been mitigated by the window between. Beside Joan, Aaron put his hand over his mouth as if he were going to be sick.
"There's nothing there," Ruth whispered. "It looks like there's something there, but there's nothing there. It's a void. All those silhouettes are just shadows."
"I know," Tom said. His gaze was averted. He couldn't even look at the view. Joan could feel it too, the horror of it. Her stomach roiled, her skin crawled. She had the feeling that if she stepped across the threshold, there'd be nothing on the other side. She'd fall and fall and fall forever. She tried not to think about that as she passed Aaron the hammer and nails to free her hands. Then she started to work on the rope. She made a loop with it, the size of the gate. As she tied the ends together, Aaron seemed to understand what she was doing. He lined up one of the nails at the left top corner of the gate's wooden frame. At Joan's nod, he tapped it with the hammer. They all stopped then, listening. Joan held her breath. There were no urgent voices, no running footsteps, no sounds at all. Joan counted to 10. Then she nodded at Aaron again. He moved over to the other corner and tapped in the other nail. Then he helped Joan hang the rope around the gate. Earlier in the night, they'd needed a long rug to cross the stretch of snow between them and the archive. But Joan hoped that here, a rope would be good enough. And she hoped it would be easier for Ruth to manage.
"I don't know about this," Ruth whispered. "I can't even feel the hunt power. It's like..."
She hesitated as if she wasn't sure how it felt.
"It's like it's burned out of me. The hunt power isn't supposed to open gates like this."
"Close your eyes," Joan whispered, "and try, just try, one more time." Ruth hesitated again. Her eyes were sunken with fatigue. Her skin was almost grey. But she touched the rope with the flat of her hand and closed her eyes. Nothing happened for a long moment.
"I can't," she started to say, and then something flashed on the other side of the gate. Joan heard Aaron gasp. For a second, the moon had been smaller and in a different part of the sky. Ruth must have felt it. She opened her eyes, frowning with concentration. She pushed the rope against the wooden frame, straining.
There was another flash, and this time it lasted long enough for Joan to see the buildings grow and shrink on the other side of the road. There was no way to know what year she'd seen. Ruth was already exhausted.
"I can't keep it open," she said.
"Okay," Joan said. "Okay, we'll have to jump across during the flash."
"You must be joking," Aaron whispered. "If the gate closes while we're crossing..."
"If Conrad finds us," Tom whispered back.
Aaron squeezed his eyes shut for a second. "All right," he said in acknowledgement. "All right, I'll go fast." He stepped up to the threshold of the rope.
"Get ready."
Ruth's face was strained with concentration. "Now." The gate flashed open and Aaron hurled himself through. And then he was gone. And there was only the shadowy city on the other side.
"Did he make it?" Ruth whispered.
"Yes," Joan whispered back, even though she hadn't actually seen him get to the other side. The flash had been too brief. She needed to believe that he'd made it. She needed to believe that he hadn't disappeared into a void.
"I'll go next," Tom said.
He stepped up to the threshold, Frankie in his arms. Joan put her own hand up against the rope, willing her own hunt power to activate. She couldn't feel anything of it. Her hunt power had failed years ago. But she couldn't just stand here while Ruth burned herself out.
"Get ready,"
Ruth said to Tom. Then, almost as fast, go! The gate flashed again, and then Tom was gone.
Two more times, Joan said, me and you.
Ruth took her time to answer. Her breath was coming in gasps.
You know I can't come with you, she managed.
Yes, you can, Joan said firmly.
You didn't even try back there at the archive, but I bet you could have.
Ruth shook her head.
I'm not leaving you here, Joan said.
Don't be an idiot.
The usual spark in Ruth's voice wasn't there. She sounded tired and flat. She started to push at the rope again.
Ruth, Joan said. Just fucking go when I say, Ruth said. I am not leaving you here.
Three, Ruth said. Two, one. The gate flashed into existence. Joan grabbed Ruth's free hand, dragging her through as she jumped. There was a flash of horrifying nothingness, and then Joan was falling out onto a pavement. She hit someone's back, Aaron's. She steadied herself against him. For a long moment, she couldn't breathe. Whatever time they were in, she could hear cars. And then she heard Ruth's voice.
You absolute idiot! You could have killed us both!
Joan swallowed, almost in tears with relief. You're the idiot.
What if you'd fallen into that timeless abyss or whatever it was? Ruth demanded. What if you'd got yourself killed?
Joan looked around. Whatever had frozen Whitehall at the stroke of midnight had lost its grip. Tourists and cars were moving again, wandering toward Big Ben and back the other way to Trafalgar Square. Otherwise, everything looked just as it had when they'd left. The cars were still low and boxy. People's clothes were still loose.
I think we're back in the 90s, Ruth said. I was aiming for the night we just left.
You did great, Joan said.
Quiet, Aaron said sharply. We're not safe yet.
They were drawing some attention from tourists walking past. Had they been seen jumping out of thin air, Joan wondered. No, people didn't look shocked enough for that. Then she saw someone give her an up and down look.
These clothes are really memorable, she murmured.
Aaron and Tom could have passed without comment, but Joan and Ruth were obviously dressed for a gala. Aaron swore. He stripped off his grey jacket, leaving him in a shirt and waistcoat. He passed the jacket to Joan. Tom passed his to Ruth. Joan slid into it, remembering the other time she'd worn Aaron's jacket, terrified and cold and covered in Gran's blood. Just like last time, she felt instantly better. The grey length covered almost three quarters of her dress. Tom's covered even more of Ruth's. Joan caught Aaron looking at her as she straightened the hem. Maybe he was remembering that night too.
Okay, she whispered to him.
He nodded. His expression was difficult to make out.
Let's get out of here, he whispered back.
Joan craned to look farther up the road. The great gate into Whitehall Palace had vanished. In its place, there were dozens of people in dark suits.
Guards, Aaron whispered.
Conrad was standing among them, illuminated by a streetlight. His blonde hair shone, reminding Joan of Aaron. Conrad bent to say something to a man with black hair and a very thin build.
That man he's talking to, Tom whispered. That's not a guard. I think that's one of the Patel family.
We should get out of here, Aaron said. To Joan, he said, the Patels can mire monsters in time. They can prevent us from travelling.
Don't they have to touch you? Ruth said.
Not if they're strong.
Tom said.
If they're strong, then they can...
The man raised a hand and Tom broke off. This guy's strong. Run, he said. But it was too late. The man made a sweeping gesture encompassing the breadth of the street, from the Westminster end to Trafalgar. The world seemed to ripple around him as if he were a dropped stone in a pond. The ripple emanated out, too fast to avoid. Joan stumbled with the power of it. Beside her, Ruth and Aaron staggered. Tom flung a hand out for balance, but managed to keep hold of Frankie. As if with some sixth sense, Conrad turned his head to them, unerring in the dark. He issued an instruction. Guards began to rush toward them.
Run,
Tom said. He pointed to Trafalgar Square, crowded with tourists, even this late at night.
Split up and run.
Joan sprinted toward Trafalgar Square. At first, she could hear the others' running footsteps, but soon she found herself alone. In their planning, Tom had suggested a rendezvous in case they got separated, an ancient stone staircase in Wapping, once used by watermen to access the Thames. It took Joan nearly 2 hours to get there. She jumped onto a bus at Trafalgar Square and stayed on it until she was sure that she hadn't been followed. After that, she made her way to Wapping on foot. On the main street, she took a dark passage past the town of Ramsgate pub on the foreshore of the Thames. She picked her way down the slippery stone stairs, trying not to fall in the dark. There wasn't much to the beach at the bottom of the stairs. It was tiny and sharp-rocked and stank of sea rot. Joan's feet crunched over sticks and pebbles and shells. There was enough moonlight to see that the tide was out. No one else was on the beach yet. Joan squeezed her hands into fists, trying not to imagine that the others had been caught. At the water's edge, Tower Bridge was unexpectedly close, still in its night lights. Nearby, on the water, Joan could just make out a bobbing rowboat, moored to something that looked homemade. Transport out of here, care of the Hathaways. They'd all get on that rowboat, and Tom would take them to a Hathaway mooring for the night. They'd decide what to do after that. Joan backed away from the shore and sat heavily on the old stone staircase. "There's something wrong about all of this," Ruth had said at the court. "I feel as if we've got something wrong." Joan dropped her head into her hands. She could hear the river lapping against the bank. In, out, in, like breathing. "We've got something wrong," Ruth had said. But the truth was, it was Joan who'd gotten something wrong. She'd made the others go to the monster court. She'd been so sure that she was right. She'd been so sure that the Transformatio would be in the Royal Archive, that she'd risked everyone's life. But she'd gotten it wrong. Instead of a device that would save her family, they'd found an empty prison cell. Gran had given Joan a key to the monster court, and Joan had wasted it. As always, the thought of Gran brought back that terrible night. Sometimes, it felt like all Joan's memories of her family had been overridden that night. When she thought of Gran, it was always of Gran in that room, dying. "Think of something else," she told herself. But the memory kept going. Gran's last words, "You're in very grave danger. Someday soon, you'll come into an ability, a power." Joan remembered how she'd stood outside the door to the Royal Archive. She'd slammed her hand against the lock and power had poured out of her. And after she'd touched it, the metal had been as dull as stone, as if she'd somehow returned it to ore. She thought about the dark marks on the necklace. What had she done to that lock? To that chain? Had she transmuted the metal? Was that her power, to change metal into stone? Joan clenched and unclenched her hand, trying to feel for that strange power again. But whatever she'd done at Whitehall, she couldn't feel a spark of it now. She wasn't sure how long she sat there before a low whistle made her jump. She turned. Tom's bulky silhouette was at the top of the stairs. "Don't get up, I'll come to you," he called down softly. He jogged down the slippery stairs with the sure foot of a boatman. Frankie trotted behind him with cheerful huffs. Tom got person size and then Tom size, stumbling up to Joan, all muscles and dopey good humour. "All right," he said. "Took me a while to get here." "I'm fine. The others haven't arrived yet," Joan said. "What if they've been caught?"
"I saw Aaron around Temple. Ruth too. Don't worry. They're not far behind."
Tom's battered face cut into a smile.
"Here."
He unhooked a woman's handbag from his shoulder and opened it to show Joan that it was bulging with pork pies.
"Stole us some breakfast."
Joan pictured him taking time out from dodging the palace guards to snatch a purse. Then she pictured him emptying out the keys and cash to make way for something he really valued. In spite of her worry about Aaron and Ruth, she found herself wanting to laugh. Apparently, you could rely on Tom to keep things simple. She felt in her pocket. The marzipan lions she had taken from the palace hadn't fared well. One was missing its tail. The other was missing its head. Oh well. She offered them to him anyway.
If Ruth or Aaron bring some drinks, we'll have a proper picnic.
She patted the step and shuffled over to make room for him. Tom grinned, but he didn't sit down as Joan had expected.
And the other thing, he said, you have that too, right?
Joan looked up at him. She hesitated. What? The sky was a pre-dawn grey now. A trick of the light had put Tom's mouth in shadow, removing some of the usual slackness from his expression.
I thought it would be in his bedding, Tom said. Did you find it under the desk?
Joan stared at Tom's silly face, except that right now, his eyes were strangely sharp. The scar across his eyebrow was a pale slash in the morning light. He looked more like a thug than ever. She had found something at the court, she remembered suddenly. Something wedged into the notch under the desk. She'd forgotten about it in the rush to escape.
I don't know what you mean, she whispered.
Let's not insult each other, Tom said, almost gently. Neither of us was going to leave that room empty-handed, and you made the first move to leave. Joan got to her feet slowly, careful to telegraph her movements in case he took it as an attack. Tom had seemed a gentle giant, not stupid, but slow and a little clumsy at times. Right now, though, he didn't seem so slow, and if he wasn't slow, maybe he wasn't clumsy at all. Joan put her hand against her pocket. She could feel the thing she'd found, a square of lightweight plastic. She'd barely glanced at it before she'd pocketed it. It had been white, with no markings. She'd dismissed it as unimportant when she'd retrieved it. But now she wondered.
Whatever you think I have, she said, I don't.
Tom's expression seemed so sharp now that he could have been a different person. Joan found herself remembering suddenly how she'd met him. He'd approached her. He'd called out to her at the market when he'd seen her necklace. He'd known it was a key to the monster court. Later, Ruth had said that he was a former court guard. Everyone at the market knew, she'd said. Had Tom deliberately spread information that he'd been a guard? Had he known Joan would turn to him, needing a guide inside the court? Tom gave her a crooked smile.
You know they used to hang pirates here?
His tone was casual, but something about the way he said it made Joan's heart thump.
They hung Captain Kidd right there.
He nodded at the stone wall at the back of the stairs. Green algae covered two-thirds of the stone, an ominous sign of how high the Thames could climb. This place isn't much in this time, he said, but it used to be like Victoria Station here. Kids running around the docks, whelk sellers calling out their wares. Whelks, whelks, penny a lot. And the river was so full of boats that we'd all be bumping up against each other. Tom took the last steps in a casual stride. Joan stumbled back, water splashed. She looked down to see that the river was pooling around her feet. The tide was coming in.
They had to hang Captain Kidd twice, Tom said. First time, the rope snapped and he thumped down into the mud. The whole crowd thought he'd get a reprieve, that since the rope had snapped, he'd be spared. But he wasn't. He was hung again, and the second time, it took.
His eyes had glazed, as if in memory, but when Joan shifted her weight, they sharpened again. And afterward, they put him on a pole and let the Thames take him three times. Three tides.
What do you want? Joan said. What did any of us want? He said. To get to the Royal Archive. He almost spat the word, but he wasn't there.
He? Joan felt like a complete idiot then. She'd assumed that the archive had been a room somewhere in the palace. It hadn't occurred to her that the archive and the prisoner had been one and the same. Did that mean, Joan blurted, he's the Transformatio? He's the device. He's the one who can change the timeline.
Tom made an impatient sound. There's no device. The Transformatio really is just a myth. There's no way to change the timeline.
He held out his hand. But I know he left something in that room. Give it to me.
Joan wanted to take another step back, but she couldn't. The staircase was blocked by Tom's big frame. Behind Joan, the river was rising. The water swirled around her feet, lapping at the bottom of her dress. She put her hand in her pocket and closed her finger and thumb over the plastic square.
I'm a hunt, she warned him. Had they ever mentioned her lack of the hunt power in front of Tom? If I hide it, you'll never find it.
You won't do that, Tom said. Step back or I will.
A male voice in the distance made them both tense.
Maybe if we'd gone through Cheapside, as I'd said, we'd have been here ages ago.
Aaron. Joan breathed out, relieved. She had never been so glad to hear his tetchy tone.
Then, less distantly, guards were all over the square mile, you idiot.
Ruth.
It's 3-1 now, Joan said to Tom. But it wasn't, not quite yet.
Do you even know what you found? Tom said, low and intense. It's a message, but you won't be able to decode it.
Oh, but you could, I suppose.
Yes, Tom said. The message was meant for me.
Joan hesitated then.
For you?
Ruth and Aaron's bickering was getting closer. In a second, they'd be upon them. Tom would glance up, and Joan would have a moment to shove him off the stairs. Still, she hesitated. What was she missing? Why would the prisoner have left you a message? Who was he? And why had Nick been looking for him? There was too much that Joan didn't understand. Tom shifted on his feet as if weighing his options.
Don't come any closer, Joan warned him. I'll use the hunt power to hide it.
You won't use the hunt power, Tom said. Why do you keep saying that?
Aaron appeared at the top of the stairs.
Oh, good.
You're both here, he called down. He started to descend.
Because you don't have the hunt power, Tom said. He bent close and put his mouth to Joan's ear. I saw what you did to that lock, he whispered.
A chill rippled through Joan's body.
Someday soon you'll come into an ability, Gran had said.
A power.
You can trust no one with the knowledge of it.
Tom straightened just as Ruth came into view too. Then, as though Joan weren't in any kind of threat at all, he turned his back on her deliberately.
You took your time, he called up to the others.
Joan stared at his broad back. Aaron had already begun descending the slippery stairs.
Guards are everywhere, he was saying.
Hey, just stay up there, Joan called up to Aaron.
She felt cold all over. Aaron would have more leverage if he stayed above them.
Tom's not who we thought, she wanted to say. Ruth was right. I got something wrong about this.
But something about the way Tom had said, the message was meant for me, gave her pause.
Just stay there, she called up again, because Aaron was still walking down. She kicked up water to show him that the river had reached the bottom step.
Tide's coming in.
No, we have to go right now, Ruth said, and now she was picking her way down too, while there's still some darkness to hide us.
Guards are everywhere, Aaron said.
You don't even know. His tone was urgent. We can't go to the Hathaways, Joan said.
No way were they getting into a boat with Tom. No way were they going to the Hathaways, where they'd be entirely in Tom's power. But neither did Joan want to escalate this. Not until she knew what was going on. And now, finally, Aaron slowed his descent.
Your family didn't come through, he said to Tom.
Tom shrugged. He turned back to Joan, looking at her as intently as she was watching him, maybe wondering why she hadn't ratted him out yet. Joan was kind of wondering that too.
The message was meant for me.
Our shoes are getting wet, she said to Tom quietly. That wasn't quite true,
The tide had only risen to Joan's step.
Tom's feet were still dry.
Tom shifted his weight. He was a big man, but looming above her, he looked like a giant. If there was a scuffle, Joan knew who'd come out best. The stairs were lethally slippery with lichen, and Hathaway territory was the Thames and canals. Tom had grown up on the water. Joan raised her voice to address Aaron. "Where can we go?" "If not the Hathaways," Aaron said. It was more than one question. Tom didn't take his eyes off Joan, but to her surprise and relief, he backed up a step. "Not the Hathaways," he agreed, answering one of them. Joan didn't dare blink as she climbed above the tide. She half thought Tom would try something while she was off balance, but he didn't move. He hadn't touched her when they'd been alone together either, she realized slowly. He'd threatened her, but he hadn't hurt her. He could have easily taken what she'd found by force, but he hadn't. She couldn't understand it. "We need to get somewhere now," Ruth said. "Not an inn or a human hotel," Tom said. "The court will have guards all over them." "We can't go to my family. They'd turn us all in," Aaron said. Ruth usually took any opportunity to bait Aaron about the Olivers, but she only said tensely, "Then where?" "There's nowhere else to go," Aaron said. "Nowhere off the court's radar. They have access to every human record. They have spies everywhere. They know every—" His mouth snapped shut suddenly. From his expression, he'd realized something. "Aaron?" Joan said. Aaron's gaze lifted to her face. There was an intensity in his expression that wasn't usually there. Without knowing why, Joan found it hard to breathe under the weight of his attention. The river washed in and out. A bird chirped and was answered by another. Morning was coming upon them fast, and still Aaron just looked at Joan. "Aaron?" she said uncertainly. His gaze left her, finally, turning to the water. "There's a safe house in Southwark," he said. "The court doesn't know about it." "How do you know?" Ruth said. "My mother told me," Aaron said. His tone was final. It was clear that no more questions were allowed. He turned and walked up the stairs. Chapter 19. The sky was still mostly grey as they walked from Wapping, being even more careful than usual not to get caught by security cameras. Beside Joan, Ruth was quiet. Joan was worried about her. Ruth had already been exhausted back at the palace, and now she was out of breath just from walking. Joan put an arm around her, trying to take some of her weight, but she knew that if anything happened, Ruth wouldn't be able to run. "How far is the safe house?" she asked Aaron. "Not far." Aaron glanced at Ruth. If Joan didn't know better, she'd have said he was worried too. "But we'll have to cross the river." To Tom, he said, "Are you sure your family can't spare a boat?" "They can't," Joan said flatly. Aaron blinked, but to Joan's surprise, Tom backed her up. "We'd be seen crossing the river by boat." Joan could feel the wary tension between them. She hadn't told the others what had happened at the watermen's stairs. She didn't even know why. The sensible thing would be to get herself and the others away from Tom. "The message was meant for me," Tom had said. Joan had been turning those words over and over in her mind. It hadn't even been the words. It had been the way he'd said them. She couldn't make sense of it all. Gran's key to the monster court, the cover-up of Nick's killings, rumours of a device that could change the timeline, an empty prison cell where the device should have been. "The message was meant for me." Joan felt as though she'd found pieces of a puzzle but didn't understand the picture they'd make when fit together. There was still something missing, something she didn't understand. But what? "It's almost dawn," Aaron said. "We need to get to the other bank before daybreak." He chewed his lip. "We're close to Tower Bridge." "The bridges will be watched," Ruth said. "We might be lucky," Aaron said. As they approached Tower Bridge, Aaron swore under his breath. Blue lights flashed from parked police cars. There was a police checkpoint at the bridge. Cars and pedestrians were being questioned and searched.
Those police are monsters, Aaron whispered. Most of them, anyway.
How is that possible? Joan said.
The court places monsters high up in human circles.
Won't all these Londoners find this strange? Joan said.
They're used to it, Tom said. In this time, there are IRA bombings for years on either side of us.
He ran a hand over his face.
If there's a checkpoint here, there'll be a ring of security around London. Court guards will be all over the tube.
It was true that the motorists weren't asking questions as the supposed police peered through their windows. As Joan watched, a car was allowed to roll through. A police officer beckoned the next car with a gloved hand.
They're letting people through, Joan said. What if we just walked down the pavement? How would they know we were the ones?
We can't be seen, Aaron said tightly.
There are Olivers and Griffiths among the guards.
Ruth breathed a curse.
The Griffith family can induce truth, she whispered to Joan tiredly. Any monster who passes through will be stopped and questioned.
We're losing night, Tom said.
We could try the tunnel to Rotherhithe, Ruth said. It isn't far.
That tunnel was closed to foot traffic more than a century ago, Aaron said. Only trains use it now.
There are still ways through it, Ruth said. If we're quick, we'll make it before the first train.
Joan exchanged a glance with Aaron. The last thing Ruth looked right now was quick. Ruth guided them away from Tower Bridge to a round brick structure, filthy with caked dirt. Tufts of grass sprouted from cracked concrete around the brick.
Lavatory, Aaron said dubiously.
A ventilation shaft, Ruth said.
With two fingers, she mimed walking up onto the roof of the shaft and then climbing down and down and down. Joan could feel Ruth shaking with exhaustion as she and Tom boosted her up. Tom hoisted himself up next, one-handed, his muscles shifting with the effort. He'd tucked Frankie under one arm, and she craned inquisitively over his shoulder.
I'm fine, Ruth mumbled. I'm fine.
But she seemed to be saying it to herself, hoping to make it true. They climbed down, three levels at least. Ruth's gasping breaths got louder and louder. By the time they got to the bottom, her arms were shaking so much that Tom had to help her down the last rungs of the ladder.
Are you all right? Joan whispered.
Ruth nodded.
Listen for trains, she managed.
They were in an underground tunnel with a high, curving ceiling. Strips of metal arched overhead at regular intervals. Down the tunnel, the effect was of concentric arches. The wall was lit with old-fashioned swan-necked lamps. Train tracks ran along the ground.
Don't touch the tracks, Ruth warned. They're electrified.
What happens if a train comes? Joan asked. Ruth gestured ahead. Between each pair of lamps, there was a recessed archway. There wasn't one tunnel, but two, Joan realized, with the archways connecting them. There was a glint of something bright near Joan's foot. She wiped at the ground with her shoe. Under the dirt, between the tracks, there were tiles, white and blue, with a winding floral pattern.
There used to be a market down here in the 1800s, Aaron said. People sold souvenirs in these archways. There were fortune tellers, monkeys.
Don't tell me you came slumming down here, Ruth said.
Tourists and slum dwellers are the best people to steal time from, Aaron said.
When Joan looked over at him, he shrugged.
What?
You know this is wrong, Nick had said.
Joan thought about standing among all those gifts to the king, those marvels, those horrors. She was struck with a sudden and intense yearning, so strong that for a moment she was afraid she was trying to travel. But it wasn't a yearning for a different time. It was for Nick, for the Nick she'd known before all this. She remembered again the time he'd rescued the wasp. It had been stuck in the guilt room, rattling behind a curtain.
"Kill it," one of the tourists had said, but Nick had captured it in a cup and released it outside.
"It's just in the wrong place," he said.
Joan had trusted Nick's judgment, his moral compass. Just being near him had made her feel like the person she had wanted to be. And now, she folded her arms around herself. She was so morally compromised now. It had been at the back of her mind all the time since the pit. She remembered telling Gran all those years ago that she wanted to be Superman.
"You're a monster," Gran had said.
As they walked down the tunnel, Joan became aware of a humming sound getting louder and louder.
"What's that noise?"
"It didn't sound like a train."
"The pumps," Ruth said.
"We must be under the river," Aaron said.
Joan looked up at the ceiling. The air smelled of damp concrete. It was scary to think that the Thames was roaring above them. It reminded Joan of the wave of power that had engulfed them as they'd fled Whitehall.
"What exactly happened to us outside Whitehall?" she said. "What did that man do?"
"He hit us with the Patel family power," Aaron said. "He mired us in time. We won't be able to travel again until the strike wears off."
"It wears off?" Joan said.
There was a pause before Aaron answered, as if he'd heard something strange in her voice.
"Eventually," he said.
"Difficult to say how long we'll be stuck in this time," Tom said. "Could be a day, could be months."
"One of the Victorian-era Hunts stole a Patel chop once," Ruth said to Joan. "The Patels mired her for years, forced her to live in a time she'd been in before."
"What happened?" Joan asked.
Aaron had told her the rules. You couldn't be in the same time twice. The timeline didn't allow it.
"What happens if you're in a tunnel and can't get out of the way of a train?" Aaron said, dry.
"We don't know what happened to her," Ruth said. "People who meet themselves in time vanish. Some people think that the timeline flings you away into its outer reaches, or that you vanish into nothingness."
"It's rare," Aaron said. "The timeline doesn't allow you to jump into a time you already occupy, and if you get too close just by living, you start to feel an intense urge to leave. But you can live your way into it, whether by being mired or stubborn. The Olivers say that if that happens, you get pushed outside time itself."
Outside time itself. Joan shivered, thinking of that shadowy abyss of nothingness outside the walls of the monster court.
"What's the point of speculating?" Tom growled. "Either way, you're gone."
That seemed to silence them all. They walked through the tunnel, listening for trains. Joan imagined what this place must have looked like in the 1800s, lit up with gas lamps and crowded with market stalls and tourists in suits and long dresses.
"Are we going to talk about what else happened at the Monster Court?" Ruth said finally. She was flagging. Her voice was getting more and more hoarse and tired.
"What's there to talk about?" Aaron said.
"We didn't find the device," Ruth said. "We can't change the timeline."
Joan glanced at Tom and found him looking back at her.
"There's no device," he said at the waterman's stairs. No device meant no way to save their families. Joan couldn't bear to think about that yet. "What's there to talk about?" Aaron said again. "We failed. We came out empty-handed. We barely escaped with our lives, and now Conrad is after us. We'll live out the rest of our lives running from godforsaken time to godforsaken time, and one day we'll turn a corner, and Conrad will be standing there."
Ruth said, "Listen, if you're going to..."
Joan held up her hand to quiet them. There was a glint of light ahead. A train?
"We're almost through," Tom said, and Joan realized that she was seeing daylight.
From bank to bank, it didn't take long to walk under the river. And outside, dawn had finally broken. The tunnel emerged where a train would have
right into Rotherhithe Station platforms on either side. There was a security guard on one of the platforms. He paced away from them. From his posture, he seemed both cold and bored. He was clearly waiting for trains and not expecting anyone to walk out of the tunnel.
Monster, Joan mouthed to Aaron. Can't see, Aaron mouthed back. He needed to see the man's eyes, Joan remembered.
Silently, Ruth pointed out one camera and then another one. Tom boosted each of them up onto the opposite platform. Before the guard could turn, they tiptoed up the stairs, and then they were out of the station on the south side of the river. The south bank was more industrial than in Joan's time. The breeze across the river smelled like tar. As they made their way west, Joan felt those jolts of alienation and familiarity that she was beginning to associate with this time. London Bridge and Tower Bridge looked just the same, but the Shard was missing. The Millennium Bridge was missing. Ahead of her, Aaron held Ruth's elbow to keep her steady, solicitous and gentlemanly. Joan wondered, not for the first time, which period Aaron had actually grown up in. He sometimes seemed to slip into manners from another age. Or maybe he wasn't from anywhere. Maybe monsters just travelled and travelled through the past and the future, never stopping for long.
You haven't told them, Tom said softly to Joan.
Joan wasn't sure if it was a question or an observation. Even more softly, he said,
They don't know about that power of yours either, do they?
Joan shivered, remembering again how she'd slammed her hand against the lock. Power had poured out of her, and when she'd lifted her hand, the metal had turned into ore. They'd fallen a little behind the other two, and now Tom slowed even more. Joan was suddenly very aware of his muscled bulk.
Walk faster, she said.
Tom smiled crookedly, but he lengthened his steps again just enough to keep pace with the others. His gaze turned to the river.
You can almost imagine that you can see the territories of the great families from here, he mused. Olivers and Allies in the west, Novaks and Argents north. Griffiths and Tawalus south, Patels and Portelius east, Lewes, the centre, Hathaways, the river, and the Nightingales. He paused slightly. Anywhere they please.
He'd missed a family. And the Hunts, Joan said.
And the Hunts, Tom acknowledged, always moving around the edges of other monsters' territories. As a child, I used to think they were running from something.
Ahead of them, Aaron and Ruth turned into a narrow alley. Stay in front of me, Joan warned Tom. The buildings here were built close and sunless, warehouses and converted factories.
You need to give me what you found, Tom said softly.
What is it?
I told you. It's a message.
Joan shook her head. I'm going to need to know more than that. A muscle jumped in Tom's jaw. That was the only warning Joan had before the sudden burst of violence. In one fast movement, Tom had closed the gap between himself and the others. He threw Ruth and Aaron into a wall with easy strength. Before Joan could react, Tom was shoving her too. Joan's shoulders hit the wall. After a stunned moment, she dove at him. He pushed her back again, almost casually, with one big hand. Joan was furious with herself. Tom had shown her exactly what he was at the rendezvous, and she just... A car door slammed nearby. Joan froze. Tom stared at Joan meaningfully, one finger at his lips. Shh. He released his grip on her. She realized then that Tom had pushed her and himself into a doorway recess. Aaron and Ruth were in an identical recess opposite. Anyone looking from the street would see an empty alleyway. Two more car doors slammed, then footsteps sounded. Joan risked peering around the recess. About 20 paces away, a woman and two men were walking into the alley from the street. Joan pulled back again, heart thumping. They were all wearing pins with winged lion insignia.
All three were easily Tom's height, although not quite as muscular in build.
"How much longer?"
one of the men said. "We've been patrolling all night."
"There was a sighting near here," the woman said.
"There've been sightings all over. You ask me, they've already escaped this time."
"They were hit by Sai Patel himself. They're still here," the woman said. "Conrad pulled guards in from all over. Took me out of the Victorian era. If he did that, he needs them found."
The footsteps got closer. Joan could hardly breathe. In the doorway opposite, Ruth and Aaron looked terrified. The doorways were too shallow to hide any of them completely. If the guards just looked, properly looked down the alleyway, they'd see all of them standing there.
"Do you believe the rumours," the woman said, "of strange powers used in the archive? Something forbidden?" She lowered her voice. "Something wrong."
"Above my pay grade," the man said.
"What about that other tip-off, though?" the woman said, "about a half-human girl with a strange power. That can't be a coincidence."
Joan couldn't breathe at all now. They were talking about her. In the opposite doorway, Ruth's face creased with confusion. She had no idea what the guards were talking about, not about the power and not about the tip-off. Joan had a suspicion of where the tip-off had come from.
"Dorothy Hunt is not a good person," the innkeeper had said.
Joan's gran would never have hurt her. But the woman in the bar. Joan remembered how that young version of gran had looked at her, as if Joan were nothing to her. Horribly and annoyingly, Joan felt tears prickling. She clenched her teeth, forcing them back.
"Wouldn't mind that reward, though,"
the man said.
"A favour from Conrad himself," the woman said. "Imagine that."
The tips of their long shadows reached Joan's feet. Tom touched Joan's hand to get her attention. "Ready?" he mouthed to her. Joan was almost too tense to nod. Tom gave her a slight smile, trying to be reassuring.
"Me first," he mouthed.
The shadows stayed motionless. The moment seemed to stretch and stretch. If not for Tom's chest rising and falling beside her, Joan would have thought that time itself had frozen again. She began to shake from unused adrenaline. Beside her, Tom's muscles were smooth and ready as though he could have waited all day in that tensed posture. A sudden loud noise made Joan jump. It sounded like the squeaky music from an old-fashioned video game. The woman groaned.
"Just because we're in the 90s doesn't mean you need a ringtone," she complained.
"There was a sighting near Rotherhithe Station." It was the second man, the one who hadn't spoken yet.
And now, finally, sounds of movement, the shadows began to retreat.
"Were they caught on camera?" the first man said.
"If they'd been caught on any camera, we'd have them already," the woman said. She sounded impatient.
"Get in," the taciturn man said. "Conrad wants..."
Then the car door slammed shut, and his voice cut off abruptly. Joan waited while the car drove away, the rumbling of it quieting until the alley was silent. Beside her, Tom relaxed, slowly, his body loosening. He'd saved them, Joan thought. He'd protected them from the guards. Joan couldn't make sense of it. He'd pretended to help them to get into the archive, then he'd seemed about to betray them, and now he'd saved them instead. He could have turned Joan in. There was even a reward, but he hadn't. Why? As she turned, she found herself caught in Aaron's direct line of sight. He was still in the doorway, and he was looking at her in the same intense way he had at the Waterman's stairs. Before Joan could say anything to him, Aaron pushed abruptly away from the door.
"Come on," he said. "The safe house is this way."
Chapter 20. The safe house was unexpectedly homey. There were family photos on the hallway walls, the kind only interesting to someone's mum.
A little girl dressed as a pirate, her dad kneeling to tie the eye patch. The same girl older and asleep next to a napping cat. A whole family shot, mum, dad, girl, and a new baby. Joan stopped abruptly in the hallway. Had they broken into someone's actual home? Aaron hadn't had a key. Ruth had had to pick the lock. Aaron stumbled into her back, and Joan turned just enough to put a finger in front of his lips, not quite touching him. He gave her an incredulous look. Behind him, Tom lifted his head, alert. They listened. Nothing. No creaking floorboards, no whispered phone conversations with the police, no water running, no fridge buzzing. A minute passed. 2 minutes. Aaron's expression shifted from incredulous to irritated. "Oh, for heaven's sake," he said finally, in his normal superior voice. "There's no one here. It's, as I told you, a safe house." "Sorry if I didn't want to just blunder in," Joan said, but her heart wasn't in it. No one was home. The house was too cold, the air too stale. If the family in the photographs had ever lived in this house, they weren't here now. "How did you know about this place exactly?" Ruth asked Aaron.
"It doesn't matter," Aaron said.
That was even less information than he'd given at the Waterman's stairs. Again, there was a flatness in his tone that brooked no questions. They trooped in, shoes loud against the floorboards. The hallway opened into a cozy sitting room. Aaron collapsed onto a fat little sofa piled with cushions. Frankie huffed and flopped onto the floor next to him. She seemed as tired as the rest of them. Ruth stopped at a bedroom door, looking longingly at the bed. "Lie down," Joan told her. "I'll check the place out." The house was simple enough. Sitting room, one bedroom, kitchen, bathroom, separate toilet. Joan opened every cupboard big enough to hold a person, flinging them open at first, SWAT style, and then opening them with more and more sheepishness. So, no one was hiding in the Aaron cupboard then. In the kitchen, animal magnets and postcards covered the fridge. Spain, Cornwall, Wales. Joan plucked off a postcard from Dover. "Wish you were here," floated above the cliffs. She flipped it over. The writing side was blank, the 50p price tag still stuck to the corner. She opened the fridge, empty and dark. A little wooden table was nestled into the corner of the room. At first glance, it had seemed battered, as all kitchen tables were. But Joan could see now that the top was unmarked and dusty. Had anyone ever eaten at it? She replaced the postcard and folded her arms around herself. The whole house seemed creepy suddenly. An empty movie set. A furniture display room. "Hey," someone said behind her. Joan jumped and spun around. Tom gave her an apology.